This is VOA News. I'm Jim Bertel. The United Nations has issued an urgent appeal for a two-hour truce in the suburbs of Tripoli to evacuate civilians and those wounded as forces loyal to military commander General Khalifa Haftar continue a push aimed at taking the capital. Libya's UN-backed prime minister is calling the action by Haftar an attempted coup. Haftar and his forces appear to have gained ground along the outskirts of the capital, but government troops say they are prepared to confront them. The UN mission in Libya has urged all parties in the area to respect a two-hour humanitarian truce. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he will annex Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank if he wins another term in office. In a television interview, Netanyahu said he would extend Israeli sovereignty to settlements and would not transfer sovereignty to the Palestinians. Senior Palestinian official Saeb Erekat says Netanyahu's latest pledge and his past actions are destroying the two-state solution, and that it is the responsibility of the international community to do something about it.
This is throwing the region as a whole into the cycle of violence, counter-violence, and chaos. And this man, Mr. Netanyahu, should be held accountable to all the actions and policies that he's pursuing to destroy the two-state solution.
U.S. President Donald Trump and White House officials are rejecting reports that the release of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's full report would prove more damaging than the initial conclusion. The initial summary of the report on the 2016 Trump campaign's contacts with Russia said neither Trump nor his aides conspired with Moscow to help him win. From Washington, this is VOA News. Rwanda is marking the 25th anniversary of the worst genocide in recent history. The 100-day period of commemoration began Sunday with a ceremony and speech from President Paul Kagame. VOA's Isha Sarai reports.
Rwandan President Paul Kagame thanked survivors and commended the progress the country has made.
In 1994, there was no hope, only darkness. Today, light radiates from this place.
The commemoration began with the lighting of the flame and laying of wreaths at the Kigali Genocide Memorial in the capital city of Kigali, where close to 250,000 remains were buried. In all, about 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus were slaughtered by ethnic Hutu extremists during a 100-day period in 1994. Isha Sarai, VOA News, Washington.
Pakistan is warning rival India is planning to launch a fresh military assault against the country. Islamabad is calling for the international community's urgent diplomatic intervention to deter New Delhi from endangering regional peace and stability. Pakistan's foreign minister says the attack could come in mid-April. The warning comes amid simmering tensions since February 26th, when Indian jets crossed deep into Pakistan territory and allegedly destroyed the suspected training camp of a militant group plotting terrorism in the divided Kashmir territory. British Prime Minister Theresa May says the longer it takes to find a compromise with the opposition Labour Party to secure a Brexit deal, the less likely it is that Britain will leave the European Union. Reuters' Pascale Davies reports.
A warning from Britain's Prime Minister to try to stop Brexit slipping from her grasp. On Saturday, Theresa May said the longer it takes to find a compromise deal with the opposition Labour Party, the less likely it is the UK will leave the European Union at all. May and the Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn have held 3 days of meetings to attempt to agree to a Brexit deal Parliament will say yes to. The Sunday Times newspaper reported the Prime Minister does have a plan to put a customs agreement with the EU in law, with the hope this softer approach would win over the Labour Party. This would likely enrage many of her Leave-supporting Conservatives.
That's Reuters' Pascale Davies reporting. A war monitor says shelling killed 13 civilians in northwest Syria today. The violence was the latest to threaten a seven-month-old truce intended to stave off a regime offensive on the region held by Syria's former al-Qaeda affiliate. From Washington, I'm Jim Bertel, VOA News.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotte in Washington.
The issue of Rwanda and Burundi, Rwanda seems to ignore it. It doesn't even hasn't shown any interest in solving that particular issue that I believe is affecting so many people.
Rwanda marks 25 years of the end of the genocide.
The opposition party said that they have been in dialogue with the government since 2014, and now it's 5 years, they get nothing. They said this regime has no credibility, has no confidence on it. So what the Bashir says, it is just like a camouflage to speak off on power for a few times ahead.
Sudanese protesters continue their demand for President Omar Hassan al-Bashir to step down.
He says that the situation in Libya has been worrisome over the past few years with respect to the lack of stability and spread of terrorism, increasing the danger to the Libyan people.
And forces loyal to General Khalifa Haftar gain ground along the outskirts of the Libyan capital, Tripoli. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. African heads of state and government join Rwandans as the country marks 25 years of the end of the genocide Sunday. The 1994 genocide left an estimated 800,000 Tutsi and moderate Hutus dead during a 100-day massacre. A series of activities have been planned for the week, beginning with President Paul Kagame laying a wreath at the genocide memorial site. For more on the activities to mark the 25 years of the end of the Rwandan genocide, I reach Edward Rema, VOA Central African Service reporter, who is on a special assignment to cover the ceremony in the Rwandan capital, Kigali.
The event to mark the 25th anniversary of the genocide against the Tutsi underway at Kigali Convention Center. They were preceded by the lighting of the flame and laying wreaths at the Kigali Genocide Memorial, where close to 250,000 remains were buried. There was 1 minute of silence to remember the victims of the genocide against the Tutsis in Rwanda. One other thing I might tell you that several heads of government and state are represented here. Among them, there is Idriss Déby of Chad, President Sassou Nguesso of the Republic of Congo, Ismail Omar Guelleh, the President of Djibouti, Mahmoud Issouf of Niger, there is also the Prime Minister of Belgium, Charles Michel, the Prime Minister of Ethiopia, Abiy Ahmed, Julie Payette, who is the Governor General of Canada, and other dignitaries are also here.
Let's talk about the neighboring countries, Burundi and Uganda. There have been recent disagreements. Why are they not having their heads of state there? This is a pivotal occasion in the life of their neighbor. Why is this diplomatic tension between these two countries affect their representation?
Peter, I will tell you that on Friday, we had an opportunity to have an exclusive interview with the Rwandan Foreign Affairs Minister, Dr. Richard Sezibera. And we put those questions to him. He said the reasons why Uganda and Rwanda are at loggerheads is because Uganda is harboring and supporting anti-Rwandan element, people who want to destabilize Rwanda. We asked him whether Uganda would be represented. He said Uganda was invited, but they chose to send the Minister of Foreign Affairs to lead the Ugandan delegation. When we asked about Burundi, he said there was no invitation that was sent to Burundi. So right now, as you know, they've been trying to find a way to meet. That's Rwanda and Uganda. But on the other side, the issue of Rwanda and Burundi, Rwanda seems to ignore it. It doesn't even hasn't shown any interest in solving that particular issue that I believe is affecting so many people. We've had reports of Rwandan officials advising Rwandans not to go to Burundi. And again, those same advices have been also given to Rwandans not to go to Uganda, because they maintain that when Rwandans go to Uganda, they are arrested and left to stay in jail for longer time.
Now, let's talk about France. We understand that Rwanda has often accused France of playing a key role in the genocide. Talk to me about what you're hearing on the ground about this.
Rwanda and France have had a very not so good relationship. But since the President Macron went to power, there have been some signs of the two countries mending their relations. For example, the President of France, Emmanuel Macron, was the one to put his support behind Rwanda's then Foreign Affairs Minister, who was later chosen to be the Secretary General of Francophonie. We've had President Paul Kagame going to France. Rwanda had invited President Macron to come here to participate in the 25th Genocide Commemoration. I think that relationship look to be improving. Like you just mentioned, just on Friday, President Macron appointed a panel of experts to look into the French government's role during and before the 1994 genocide. So I would say there's an improvement of relationship. Hopefully it continues. That's how it is now.
Edward Rema is VOA's Central African Service reporter. He spoke with me from Kigali. Meanwhile, David Himbara is an educator, political economist, and author. He is a former economic advisor to President Kagame. He tells my colleague Douglas Impuga that the conditions that led to the genocide 25 years ago still exist, since there is no freedom to discuss national issues.
People who were born after genocide have only experienced one government under General Paul Kagame. Since that time, though, no one is able to discuss issues like ethnicity, Hutu and Tutsi, the same conflicts that divided Rwandans that led to genocide. These are topics are now taboo. So we don't really know what Rwandans think, because it's a society that is in prison, that is not allowed to discuss issues that concern them. So in my view, we live now in much more dangerous times than even before, because these things are just locked away. No one can talk about anything. Freedom of expression of any kind is not allowed under the kind of totalitarian state, police state that exists in Rwanda. So the people who are born after 94, really, my answer is that we don't know what they think, because there is no platform for anyone to talk about any of this. That's my answer.
Is that not then the seed of violence like the one that led to the genocide?
No, I think even in fact it's worse. Yeah, the situation now is much worse, because you have a government that is completely totalitarian, where there's no discussion of any kind. And I'm giving you an example. You have a government today that can wake up one day and closes the border. You have a government one day that orders Rwandans not to cross a border into another country. So this is a situation where really one person controls thoughts, movements of Rwandans, totally. So we don't know what people think. So in a situation like this, it's much more dangerous for the future of the country, because basically there is no foundation that has been laid out since 1994.
And then what happened to the post-ethnic unity that Mr. Kagame was talking about in 1994?
No, the RPF of before 1994 and RPF of from 94 up now is different. The RPF of today is the one that I just described, where we basically live in a crazy situation. You don't know what is going to happen tomorrow. You don't know what will happen next week. The situation now, as I just described, is that every day you basically expect something unexpected, something that will shock you.
What do you see as the way forward to avoid what happened 25 years ago happening again?
Put it this way. In Rwanda, we have never had any peaceful transfer of power from one government to the other. It's either overthrow or shooting down, because there is no space. So I do not expect any different outcomes. It's going to be the same way.
David Himbara is an educator, political economist, and author. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from Toronto, Canada. Sudanese protesters continue to demand that President Omar Hassan al-Bashir step down and hand over power. They gathered in front of the General Command of the Sudan Armed Forces Saturday and called on the army to support them. Meanwhile, President Bashir called for a broad national dialogue to help resolve the problem. He said the talks should include both internal and external opposition groups, which would ensure transparency, justice, and public freedoms. For more regarding Saturday's protest, I read Mohammed Ali Fazari, columnist for Al Akbar Daily, a major Sudanese Arabic newspaper in the capital Khartoum.
Yesterday was memory of sacrifice in Sudan's uprising of the former regime of Jafar Mohamed Numeiri, who was removed by the popular uprising in 1985. And yesterday was a celebration of 34 years of this memory for the Sudanese, which made a big uprising against that regime. And we found that thousands of people gathering in front of army headquarters. They are raising their demand, asking President Bashir to step down from power and hand over power to the people.
Some of the protesters are saying that the army should side with the protesters to get rid of President al-Bashir. Do you foresee this happening, particularly when President al-Bashir remains the commander-in-chief of the army?
Yes, there are some meetings between President al-Bashir and High Commander-in-Chief, but no information released from that. As you know, in this situation, that the security meeting will not for public release. Yesterday, there is a rumor or news about there is an important statement from the police. People waiting till late in the night, but nobody says that. Regarding your first question about for change and freedom declaration forces, these are the four alliances that is with the Sudanese professional unions. They're working together, and also they call on their members to participate positively and in this protest. And we find that there's several of these the major political parties that they participate in these protests, which was considered to be the largest one since the beginning of the protest in 2018 and in the 19th of December. And they said that the Sudan would not be returned back to the time of before of this date. So nowadays, all the protesters raising their demands day by day, and they are calling the police, the army force to support them, and they are start chanting one people, one army. This is the same slogan raised in 1985, and at that time the police support the demand of the protesters at that time and ask the President Jafar Numeiri to step down. And now they say that history must repeat itself, and because the same situation, the same circumstances was in here. This is another dictatorship and another military regime.
The president has called for a broader national dialogue to end the crisis. Has he outlined any framework by which this will be undertaken? And what has been the response of the opposition or protesters so far?
Yeah, they think that there is no confidence of the President al-Bashir for this dialogue. The opposition party said that they have been in dialogue with the Sudanese government since 2014. And now it's 5 years, they get nothing. They said this regime has no credibility, has no confidence on it. So what al-Bashir says, it is just like a camouflage to stick off on power for a few times ahead. So they said it's now no time for any kind of dialogue, no time for any initiative. The people in the street will decide. The protesters now, they have the decision, they will say it. And this is a dialogue particularly for the parties that is in a collusion with the Sudanese government, which is called the party of the national government, not the opposition party. The opposition in their side, they said, we don't have any response to President al-Bashir call only to overthrow the regime totally with all its leaders. They said the President al-Bashir regime should be eradicated once and for all, so that the change on freedom forces, they should can build the new Sudan of democracy and Sudan of freedom.
What is the end game of these protesters? Obviously, they want President Bashir to go, but he is not going now. So what is their next line of action?
They said that they will organize an open sit-on in front of
army headquarters, and they're starting now. Since yesterday, we see people were sleeping in front of the main gate of headquarters, and some of them managed to enter the guest house, which is the main office of President al-Bashir, which is a high-ranking official of the government. This is one signal that we will never return back. Another thing that they have found support from other Sudanese from diaspora, and they found logistic support, even people bringing them food, water, and all kind of logistic support for them to stay there.
Mohamed Ali Fazari is a columnist for Al Akhbar Daily, a major Sudanese Arabic newspaper. He spoke with me from Khartoum. Forces loyal to Eastern Libyan military commander General Khalifa Haftar appear to have gained ground along the outskirts of the Libyan capital Tripoli, including the international airport south of the city. The advances by Haftar's forces are drawing expressions of concern from international actors. For VOA, Edward Uranian has more from the Egyptian capital, Cairo.
Arab media broadcast video of General Haftar's forces entering the gates of Tripoli's now closed international airport before taking position outside terminal buildings and along the now disused runways. There did not appear to be any resistance to the takeover. Arab media also showed residents of neighborhoods near the capital cheering as Haftar's forces entered. Saudi-owned Al Arabiya TV claimed that Haftar's forces had entered the Khalat al-Fargan district of the capital. VOA could not independently confirm the claim. Haftar's military spokesman, Colonel Ahmed al-Masmari, told a press conference Saturday afternoon that Libyan military forces under Haftar's command were gaining ground. He says that Haftar's forces now control the towns of Gharian, Janduba, Qasr al-Bashir, and Sawani. He says that 14 soldiers fighting with the Libyan army have been killed in fighting. The spokesman says that Air Force planes loyal to Haftar had launched at least four raids near the Bab al-Aziziya military compound south of the capital, but that there were no casualties. He claimed, however, that planes from the nearby town of Misrata, which opposes Haftar, killed a number of civilians in a raid over the town of Gharian, which Haftar now controls. As the fighting appeared to spread, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres insisted during a visit to Jordan that the UN would never give up its support for the Libyan people. UN Special Envoy Ghassan Salame, who is now in Libya, said that he was monitoring the situation closely. He says that tensions were increasing in a number of places in and around Tripoli and that he was keeping tabs on the situation minute by minute. He insists that it is urgent to put an end to tensions in those areas and to make sure civilians are not harmed. In Cairo, Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi called on the international community to take action to restore stability to the Libyan capital. Foreign Minister Sama Shoukry told visiting Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov that Libya has been out of control since the revolution that overthrew Colonel Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. He says that the situation in Libya has been worrisome over the past few years with respect to the lack of stability and spread of terrorism, increasing the danger to the Libyan people. Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov urged all parties to stop fighting and start negotiating. He says that the international community must prevent the situation from escalating. He urged Libya's warring parties to put a stop to offensive military operations and to sit down at the negotiating table. UN envoy Salami, for his part, insisted that every effort would be made to hold the upcoming National Dialogue Conference in the southern town of Radames, unless the situation on the ground made it impossible to do so. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The third edition of the International Exhibition of Information Technologies and Innovation is scheduled to be held in the Congo Republic's capital, Brazzaville, next week. The theme of the exhibition is Developing Digital Trust to Ensure a Prosperous Economy. The three-day conference, which begins on April 16, will be chaired by Prime Minister Clement Mwamba. For more on the exhibition, I reach Luke Misidimbanzi, president of the Association of Promotion Reflection Analysis of Information and Communication Technologies, or PRATIC, the organizer of the event.
But this conference is an exhibition of companies of digital, telecommunication, innovation, and all the company talk. We have the government, we have a private company, we have a civil society, and we talk together about the development of ICT in Africa. We work with all the big key players of digital and also with government. We try to promote ICT, to promote innovation. We try to talk about the new technologies. And also we have some partnership between companies and government and also country by country, like France and country.
In the 3 years since its organization, what would you say is the tangible or practical benefit that the residents of Congo Republic have had about this innovation and technology in their way of life?
First of all, you have to know that is a event for all sub-region of Central Africa. We have not only Congo, but we have Cameroon, RDC, Congo Democratic, Gabon, Chad, RCA, Burundi. All of them, they came to talk about the ICT. A benefit of the last two editions was training. We tried to train the most of 1,000 people, the young. And also, we also talked about the new improvement of the technology. And for that, we talk about the ISP, the traffic internet. And all traffic internet talk, we try to show to the country, to help them to build the new strategy. And we also help the country to develop the new technology like finance, like in agriculture and incubation. The more benefit you can we had is this support we bring to the country. And today we can measure that, but we have the ISP, we installed the ISP, we installed the new company, and we try to create the new job. We try to create also to improve knowledge skills of the young.
So how is this new technology helping the government, for example, to create more jobs for the youth, to help with agriculture, to feed the people, as well as the technological advancement of the youth to embrace? So when they go to neighboring countries, like you talked about in the Central African region, for example, they can help boost the objective, the reasons why this conference is being held. Talk to me about that.
We have to understand that new technology, digital, is not for the experts, is not for the engineer only. Today, in the digital is in our life. It means we live with that. In my life, in my job, in my distraction, in all the activities we have the digital. And today, digital help like the sector, agriculture, like if you take the example of agriculture, we help them to have the new kind of the work to accelerate it. The culture, digital helps on the quality and on the volume. It means we can go quickly, we can go better on all the activities of the development. And today, our country can have the benefit of the digital, like in administration, to help administration to be better, to help administration to have the best services to the population, like the school. Today, we can manage the school, we can manage the progress of the student by the new technology. We call them the SI, SE in French, it means System d'Information. We can improve that to become better on the services we can provide to the people. And also, we have the infrastructure. You know, in Congo and Central Africa, we built many infrastructures the 10 last years. The government invests a lot of money to build this infrastructure. Today, we have the infrastructure. It means we can build also the services. These services help the companies to become better, to become in competition of the business. And if the company today is modern, if the company has some new tool to be competitive against the company of Europe, it means we have the best economy.
Luke Misidimbanzi is president of the Association of Promoting Reflection Analysis of Information and Communication Technologies, or PRACTIC. He spoke with me from Brazzaville. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Juna, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. But first, Cameroonian officials say the number of people displaced by the separatist war in the English-speaking regions has dropped dramatically, indicating the government is winning the conflict. But non-governmental organizations say the number has remained steady at 500,000, with a huge majority living in desperate conditions. For more, Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
Paul Atanganje, Cameroon's territorial administration minister, says the situation in the northwest and southwest regions has improved greatly, and the number of internally displaced people has dropped 70% from its peak of 500,000 early last year.
Statistics from administrative authorities and NGOs working in close collaboration with the government show that there are about 152,000 internally displaced in the two regions. Inflating the number presents another danger which can even jeopardize the sovereignty of the state.
Atanganje said the government has supplied humanitarian aid to 100,000 of the displaced and will eventually reach the other 50,000 living in hard-to-access areas. He dismissed as unfounded local media reports that the aid cannot reach everyone in need because of continued clashes between the military and English-speaking separatists who seek to break away from Cameroon and its French-speaking majority. But NGOs have contested the government's figures. Lawyer Agbobala, founder and executive director of the Center for Human Rights and Democracy in Africa, says NGOs' figures are politically motivated and designed to show the government is resolving the crisis.
We have 600,000 and above, and the UN sees it's 500,000 and above, and all credible organizations are above the 500,000 mark. And these are professional organizations which have a history of doing such a job. But be it as it may, well, the focus is to ensure that the necessary aid, food and non-food items, are provided to those who are internally displaced.
Here at the Catholic Hall of the Roman Catholic Church in Bamenda, Christians sing as they receive 35 people who fled clashes last Monday between the military and separatist fighters in the town of Kumbo. Joseph Musa says he escaped with his wife and 6 children after they had counted not less than 11 corpses within a week.
We were caught inside the crossfire. Luckily for us, we know some bush roads, bush tracks. We had to find our way across the bush and streams, even spending some nights in the bush. And if we find ourselves in Bamenda, where we are crowded in a small, narrow room.
Last week, the Catholic Diocese of Kumbo said it had documented evidence that 385 civilians were killed and 750 houses torched within 7 months in Kumbo alone, and youths had deserted most villages, leaving only the very old. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter. Good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Let's begin with football. Mamelodi Sundowns stand record 8-time winners Al Ahly of Egypt with a resounding 5-0 victory in South Africa on Saturday in the first leg of their African Champions League quarterfinal. Earlier Saturday, Tanzanian club Simba SC missed a penalty as they drew 0-0 with 5-time former winners TP Mazembe of the Democratic Republic of Congo in Dar es Salaam. Tanzanian side Simba SC hosted 5-time former champions TP Mazembe of DR Congo in Dar es Salaam, boasting some formidable home form in the competition this season. Before Saturday, Simba had won all 5 qualifying and group games in Dar es Salaam, but a missed penalty from John Boko on the hour mark meant the hosts had to settle for a goalless draw against the vastly experienced Mazembe side. Later on Saturday, Horoya of Guinea also drew 0-0 with former winners Wydad Casablanca in Conakry. The last match of the day featured holders Esperance of Tunisia away to CS Constantine of Algeria. Esperance won the thriller 3-2. And now in athletics, let's take a look at some marathons held Sunday. Nancy Kiprop produced the outstanding performance of the 36th Vienna City Marathon on Sunday, when she broke the women's course record by over a minute and a half in running 2:22.12 at this AAAF Gold Labor Road race. Kiprop led the Kenyan clean sweep of the podium, with all three women setting personal bests. Angela Tanui was runner-up, and Maureen Chepkomoi came in third. In the men's race, Kenyan Vincent Kipchumba won with a personal best of 2 hours, 6 minutes and 56 seconds, improving his lifetime best by almost 4 minutes. Kipchumba surged away in the closing stages from Switzerland's Tadese Abraham, who finished second. Uganda's Solomon Mutai took third with 2:08.25, improving his best by just over 1 minute. In Hanover, Muitech and Mutga secured Kenya's double. Kenya's Silas Muitech and Rachel Mutga cruised to victory at the Hajj Hanover Marathon on Sunday. Muitech clocked 2:09.37 to take the race after running away after the 35-kilometer mark, clipping more than 7 minutes from his previous personal best. Hosea Kipkemboi of Kenya and Ethiopia's Dedas Alebetchew Wale finished second and third, respectively. In the women's race, Kenyan Rachel Mutga took command after the 35th kilometer. The 31-year-old clocked a course record of 2:26.15, lowering her own career best from 2:28.39. Tigist Mewiye Gebeyahu of Ethiopia was third, with Poland's Caroline Nadolaska fourth. And in Istanbul, Ruth Cheptengtich clocked 1 hour 5 minutes and 30 seconds to smash her own course record at the Vodafone Istanbul Half Marathon. Fellow Kenyan Dokas Jepchichir Tuitoek came second. In the men's race in Istanbul, 22-year-old Bernard Ingeno fought back Ethiopian Abene Degu's late race challenge to secure his second half marathon victory of the year, clocking 59.56. Degu was second in 59.58, knocking more than a minute from his previous best, while Hira Kipchumba finished third. Finally, in just a few weeks, Doha once again welcomes the world's best athletes for the first stage of the 2019 IAAF Diamond League, which takes place at the state-of-the-art Khalifa International Stadium on May 3rd. The Khalifa International Stadium will once again launch the series and will draw the curtain on the year when the IAAF World Athletics Championships Doha 2019 are held at the same iconic sports venue from September 28th to October 6th, the first time the World Championships will be staged in the Middle East. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African Sports. Nightline Africa Sports. A It's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. You are hearing from Harry Belafonte featuring Miriam Makeba with Malaika. Then we have Adina featuring Sarah Cordier with Makoma. Then Africando All-Stars, Me and Awe. Then we top it up with Yemi Alade, Marry Me.
Nasimbana mali sinwe, engekuwa wa malaika.
Esa za soko wa roho yangu. Esa za soko wa roho yangu.
Akuwaza kidege, kidege, akuwaza kidege, engekuwa maliwe, engekuwa dada, nasimbana mali sinuwe, engekuwa. Nashindwa na mali sinuwe, engekuwa malaika. Malaika, nakupenda malaika. Malaika, nakupenda malaika, engekuwa maliwe. Ingekuwa dada, nasimbana mali sinuwe, ingekuwa malaika. Nasimbana mali sinuwe, ingekuwa malaika.
Mama kuma bongi.
I know they hear I want you.
your fine. Unfuni na dama koma so. Girl, I wanna love you to the end of time. May your body cross to kill my son. Yeah, so don't be surprised if I kill myself all in the name of love. Me and I may be pair, will let me pay the price. So I dream you see me team while I'm filled with wrath. Beauty lies in the eyes of beholder. Oh, home to girl, I'm sober. And kind of life, I don't be chasing my door on the sofa. To see I'm irresponsible, me bomb over as a soldier. Jaina woman, kind of win you, brand your name, a soldier. Can be betrayed.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English Service of the Voice of America in Washington. And now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's One Man's Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Today marks the 25th anniversary of the genocide in Rwanda. As we approach this day, many governments and people have engaged in agonizing reappraisal of what happened and what could have been done to prevent such a tragedy. The genocide in Rwanda is not only a major tragedy for the people of Rwanda, it is also for the African continent and the wider international community. I can say that the decision of President Macron of France to set up a commission to look at the role of France is a good one, because both Rwanda and France have engaged in a dispute as to what was the precise role of France to the events that led to the genocide. Questions have also been asked. Why the United Nations, as representing the international community, did not do enough to prevent such a tragedy. I can say also definitively that as a senior official responsible for the political developments in Rwanda at the time, I did not see the much discussed telegram that was sent by the commander of the force to the United Nations, nor did the late Butosgali see it. Reason being that that message was sent not to the political people involved, but to the military advisor within the Department of Peacekeeping. Let me also take this opportunity to give my own reflection of what happened during these troubled times. The people of Burundi in July of 1993, for the first time, elected a Hutu candidate as the first Hutu president of Burundi. Hitherto, past presidents have been Tutsis. While this was welcomed internationally, in October of that same year, there were reports that there was a coup d'etat in Bujumbura and that Nanadai had been killed. I was sent by Secretary General Butosgali to go to Bujumbura and try to work with the parties to restore law and order. I did meet with the military command at the time and requested that the troops return to barracks. The military command agreed but said that there should be no vacuum, that the remainder of the Nadea government should resume office. I then met with the government of the Nadea who were taking refuge in the French embassy in Bujumbura. They refused to go to the offices or the residence because they were very convinced that the Tutsi-dominated military had a plan to remove, to kill, in fact, all Hutu intellectuals and those belonging to the political class. Even though the military command denied this, they refused to accept it. After conducting a series of shuttle diplomacy, I was able to reach an agreement with both sides, and they came out, took their places, and we pledged that the UN will intervene in some form. I arrived in New York and reported to the Security Council and the Secretary General. Regrettably, the Security Council was not willing to contemplate the dispatch of military observers to Bujumbura, but agreed that they could send a representative of the Secretary General. I came back, but in December, there was another problem in Bujumbura. The military in Bujumbura said they could not accept the Hutu-led government's decision that they should not participate in the burial of Nana Dae in the grounds of the former king of Burundi. So I had to go and negotiate between two sides. But what was significant is the tension and the belief among the Hutus that there was a plan to eliminate them. After this burial, I traveled by road from Bujumbura to Kigali to meet with the president of Rwanda, who was a Hutu. I passed on a message by the Secretary General, Butuzgali, that there are rumors that the government and people are planning a kind of revenge that may result in massacre of Tutsis. He denied it, and I left Rwanda and returned to New York. I retired from the United Nations at the end of February that year of 1994. And I went back to my home country. And while there, I followed closely what was going on. And when, at the beginning of the April, I heard that the plane carrying the president of Rwanda and also the president of Burundi had been shot down and they are dead, I knew that there was a disaster ahead. Now, we all should be grateful that the government that emerged in Rwanda had shown tremendous leadership. It had encouraged reconciliation and promoted forgiveness among the peoples. And today, Rwanda is a thriving society and country. But let me say in the end that while much has been achieved in Rwanda, there is much room for reconciliation between Rwanda and Burundi, and also forgiveness, because I can affirm that the tension is still there. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Shao Gang Chang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, words are like spears. Once they leave your lips, they can never come back. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.